And the person who's traveled the longest distance is a person who I read his article 5 years ago in The Economist. And when we read that, and I called Don, and he read it, and we just were ecstatic, jumping for joy that, my God, here's somebody over there who really has described this in an exciting way. And of course, The Economist is highly respected and worldwide in its impact. And the person who wrote that article, who was an associate editor of The Economist, is a gentleman and his wife who have flown all the way from London to be with us today as a presenter, and that is Brian Beedham. Brian, the show's yours.
Thank you, Mike. Well, as he has said, and as you can hear, I come from the other side of the water, in fact, from the place which all those years ago said that it found your Declaration of Independence a constitutionally unacceptable way of setting about things. So, I'm not going to be able to say very much in the direct form about how you might finalize your proceedings, as Mike just put it. But I want to, if I can, offer a little help in the indirect form, by which I mean to talk about some of the lessons we can draw from the oldest and most experienced and most thoroughgoing practitioner of direct democracy in the world, also from my side of the water, but not Britain, from Switzerland. And I am interested in Swiss direct democracy, partly because I have a Swiss wife, which has a very powerful effect in these matters, but also because the Swiss really do things, this thing, in a way which has no comparison anywhere else in the world. 2 or 3 or 4 times a year, the people of Switzerland, the entire voting people of Switzerland, go out and take decisions on, first, a number of federal questions, questions about the government of the federation. And in the past couple of years, my wife was showing me the documents she's brought with her. In the past couple of years, that has included the question of, do we want to start negotiations for membership of the European Union? Answer, big no. Other end of the spectrum in some ways. Should we try to reduce the cost of medicine in Switzerland by making it easier to import medicines from abroad? That's a much more detailed and precise question. Should we abolish the Swiss Army? And next year, coming up this year, Switzerland, tiptoeing into the great world outside, will ask itself whether it wants to join the United Nations. In addition to federal questions like that, you've got each year a number of questions about your cantonal government to decide, and an even larger number of questions about the commune in which you live, which can be city of Zurich, 400,000 people in that commune, or it can be a commune of 50, 60, 70 people out in the countryside. The Swiss do all this, and have been doing this for 140 years now, and I think that qualifies them to be some kind of object lesson for the rest of us. Amazingly little is known by most outsiders, especially perhaps in America, about how the Swiss run their system, though Gregory Fosdahl is about to correct that within the next week, I gather, and I'm delighted to hear it. But I would like just to say 3 lessons we might draw from the Swiss experience, and where I get my facts and figures wrong, Gregory will put me right immediately afterwards. Lesson number 1. The way the Swiss do it seems a very good demonstration of something that we've been talking about quite a bit this weekend, a very good demonstration of the proposition that direct democracy not only makes for greater democratic efficiency, that is, producing results that we clearly know most people want because they voted for it themselves rather than doing it through their parliamentarians. It not only is more democratically efficient, but at the same time, it improves the political skills of the people who are doing this. It makes people more sophisticated about politics, more careful in their decision-making, better Democrats. The phrase civic maturity, civic maturation, has come up several times. Let me, in my English phrasing, say civic maturity equals better voters. In Switzerland, what one does is not merely every 4 or 5 years make a choice between two rather blurry things called parties, which will come to you at election time and say, well, we've got 15 ideas on a range of subjects, and the other party says we've got 17 ideas of slightly different on a range of subjects. And you're asked to choose between those two parties, or three parties, or four parties, even though, in fact, you like 5 ideas at one party and 7 ideas from another party. You have to choose one or the other. You can't check what they're doing in between. That indirect or representative democracy system is a very woolly process indeed. It looks enormously woolly when you're standing in Switzerland and watching people actually taking the decisions they want to take themselves, as I say, 3-4 times a year. At the federal level, it requires only 50,000 signatures to be collected. That's a bit over 1% of the total number of qualified voters, to bring any law passed by Parliament to the judgment of the people. Will we say yes to it, or will we throw it out? It takes twice that many, 100,000 signatures, a bit over 2% of the total number of qualified voters, to bring an initiative and to tell the Parliament that it must enact this law because we have said so. The people can make those decisions to go to the vote about these things. Of course, they then get propaganda from both sides. They hear it on the radio, television, read it in the papers. But they also, God bless Switzerland, get a document, this is for the federal votes, get a document about each initiative or referendum which says what the proposed measure is, the proposed change, the arguments for and the arguments against presented by those who are for and against, and you can sit down and turn over, every voter can sit down and turn over the pages of this pamphlet and see both sides fairly and precisely set out. And you then make up your minds. The right to vote increases the responsibility of the voters. That is one of the consequences of direct democracy. In some ways, for me, one of the perhaps the most important consequence. The right to vote brings more responsible voting. Direct democracy means the end of a period when, for reasons which at the beginning perhaps had some force, a period in which it was believed that only a minority of rather superior people, better educated people, more interested people, could take the decisions on the basis of the vague choice made in general elections every few years. That period is coming to an end, in my view, inevitably, because education is spreading, wealth is spreading, the figures are readily available. You can see, well, for instance, GDP per head in Britain has increased 4 times between 1900 and now. In Italy, it's increased 14 times. In France, for every child who went to a secondary school in 1900, 60 do now. And for every child who went on to university or college, 50 do now. The figures are the same for Japan. For every child who went to a secondary school in 1900, 100 do now. We are not all perfectly educated now, but we are. There is a vast middle class which is reasonably well-to-do. It has savings. It has an education. It can decide about politics just as well as that small bunch of elected people up there. The Swiss have realized this a long time ago. The rest of us can now realize it, I think. Point two. Ah, say the skeptics. But Switzerland is a rather special kind of place. It's a country that's specially suited to direct democracy. They can do it, but we wouldn't be able to. Nonsense. Switzerland is not a cozy, united country where everybody feels the same and believes in the same things. On the contrary, Switzerland is a country with four languages, three main groups of people, German, Swiss speaking, French speaking, Italian speaking, who have very different ideas about many things, who argue furiously. This is not, as it were, it is a less united country in some ways than the United States. There's a nice crack in the Swiss Army about the fact that the highest number of casualties the Swiss Army has suffered in 200 years was when they organized the annual maneuvers, foolishly putting French Swiss and German Swiss troops on opposite sides of the line, and casualty rate was pretty high. The Swiss are not just a single people who can be assumed to work things out together easily. They're not. They're a perfectly normal bunch of people who disagree with each other. They're not special. Well, say the critics again, but it's a very tiny place, and sort of all the Swiss really know each other. Not true again. Well, true in those tiny mountain villages, true in some small suburbs of medium-sized towns, but by and large, the ordinary man in Zurich doesn't know what his neighbor thinks about the issue under dispute, who lives a mile away, any more than the person in Washington or London or wherever. Well, yes, but history shows that the Swiss have the same view of the world. In one respect, but one respect only, that is correct. Switzerland has prided itself for a long time on its neutrality because it wanted to keep out of the wars between Germany and France and Italy. So it made neutrality a principle of its foreign policy and of its attitude towards the outside world. But that is now fading fast. And the fact that membership of the United Nations is at last becoming possible, perhaps, shows that the Swiss are tiptoeing into the outside world, and with it is beginning to go their sense of neutrality, which was anyway the only idea which was really strongly universal in the whole country. Well, say the skeptics finally, but the Swiss were born to it. You know, they had direct democracy way back in the Middle Ages. Not really. And there were direct votes, popular votes, right up in small communes in the mountains back then. But it wasn't really until 1848 and 1860 that the present Swiss system of direct democracy was established with all the complexities that I have been describing. The Swiss have been doing it a long time, but they were not born to it. There is not, as it were, a god of direct democracy who has created his own special people to be a symbol of his ideas sitting in the middle of Europe. We can all do it. If they can do it, the Swiss can do it, we can too. Point three, then. Are there any particular lessons, things to pick up from what happens in Switzerland that could apply to the discussions we've been having this weekend and the way we do it ourselves, if or when we do it? Let me offer three or four. The first, and this is directed to some of the people I heard yesterday who were making rather nervous remarks about what the people might decide, what a majority of the people might do to unfortunate minorities. You know, do the people, when they have the chance of direct voting, get excited and emotional or purely selfish, pursuing their own majority ends, the majority, at a cost to the minority. The Swiss experience doesn't really fit in with that. For instance, in the 1960s, Switzerland was one of the first countries in Europe to have sort of xenophobic explosion of resistance to foreign workers coming to live and work in the country, partly because lots of them came to Switzerland sooner than they came to other countries. There was a lot of protest, a lot of bad language, a lot of rather bitter nationalism was expressed, but it came in the end to a series of direct votes, initiatives and referendums, the result of which was that a total number of foreign workers in the country, a figure was set slightly lower than the actual figure at that time, but within a short period after that, the actual figure had climbed back to where it was before and gone well beyond it. In other words, the processes of direct democracy did not support a xenophobic answer to that question. About the same time, the Swiss were asked, are you willing to pay more for your petrol, more petrol tax, to get better roads? Now, a lot of people, including some in the western states of this country, might be tempted to say, no, thank you. The Swiss said, yeah, I think it's worth it. We'll pay more taxes for better roads. Best example of all, perhaps, in one of the very first referendums they held back in 1866, a long time ago. One of the questions was, do we give equal rights to Jews? Now, at that time, anti-Semitism had not yet been shocked by the Hitler experience. There was still a lot of it about. It was not easy to get that through. It passed in Switzerland in 1866. Even then, that direct democracy was not looking for minorities to stamp on. Second specific observation about the way the Swiss do it, I would say that they are an example of the desirability of the people treating the executive power of their country and the legislative power with affection and respect as equals. The people can take the final decision when they want to, but they cooperate very cheerfully and rather successfully with the other parts of the system. In some ways, you have to leave quite a lot to the other parts of the system. For instance, military matters, which don't happen very often in Switzerland, but do happen elsewhere. I think you can't, for instance, expect to claim a direct vote on September the 12th about what to do after September the 11th here. You need an executive who can act within the law, but can act rapidly and efficiently, we hope, by himself. The voters and the legislature in Switzerland also work together remarkably well. For instance, of laws passed by the parliament which have been brought to a popular vote by a demand for a referendum, in all the period from 1866 through to now, of laws brought to a direct vote, half were accepted. They said, okay, parliament got that right. We'll accept that. Only half were rejected. Of initiatives, the things which you can get by 100,000 signatures, in which you propose something the parliament must do, in that same period, in effect, only 10% passed. In other words, most people think most of the time that parliament isn't doing badly, but if we disagree, if we think otherwise, then we can haul its laws to our judgment, or we can push our judgment and insist upon it to the parliament. The third slightly worrying particular observation about Switzerland is the drop in voting turnout in initiatives and referendums over the last 15 or 20 years. I think that is happening because it's so easy in Switzerland to get a referendum or an initiative brought to the popular vote, because of that figure, those figures of 50,000 signatures and 100,000 signatures are diminishing proportions of the total size of a fairly rapidly expanding population. In other words, the number of initiatives and referendums brought to a direct vote has been increasing steadily. Some people get a bit weary, don't turn out as much, and that's sad. Lesson, which I think the Swiss will follow, is, okay, increase the number of signatures required, thereby reducing the number of issues that come to a vote, and you'll probably find turnout turning up again. Last specific point, and in some ways one of the most stimulating of the lot to me, the Swiss are showing that voting by the direct method, voting by direct democracy, can become steadily more sophisticated as you go on. I'll give you two examples of changes that have taken place in Switzerland in the last few years, and you'll see what I mean. One is that in the canton of Bern, it is now possible to make a choice by initiative, not just as it used to be, between, for instance, spending more money on the hospital system of the canton or not spending more money on it, but a couple of years ago a vote said, do you want to spend more money on the hospitals of the canton? And if you do, here are five different ways of doing it which you can choose between. And it worked beautifully. A majority said, yes, we do, and a majority of that majority chose a specific way of doing it, and that became the law of the canton of Bern. In Zurich, there's something even more melodramatic than that. It's called the Einzelinitiative, which means that an initiative proposal with only one signature can be brought to a vote of the whole people, provided it has some support in Parliament. But if you can just get a certain number of members of Parliament to agree to countersign it, then one ordinary citizen by himself can insist on an initiative in that canton. And a man called Albert Jürger made himself famous 3 or 4 years ago by putting his own one signature on a demand for an initiative. He got the necessary support in Parliament. The initiative went to all the voters of the canton of Zurich and was passed. And the fascinating thing is that the effect of this initiative was actually to, in this particular aspect of things, to reduce the power of the people. What he was talking about was the system which, up to his initiative, meant that teachers were chosen by popular vote, and some rather odd choices had been made, most people agreed. He therefore proposed that, in fact, teachers for the canton should be chosen by a professional committee, admittedly itself chosen by the people, but a committee of professionals. This won. In other words, the people were saying, we will withdraw from part of our previously exercised power in the name of more intelligent, more efficient government. I was struck yesterday, just to finish with a general remark, I was struck yesterday by the degree of nervousness I thought I detected in various parts of the room about the danger that direct democracy will lead to clumsy, irresponsible, sometimes dangerous and brutal decisions, especially decisions in which the majority stamps upon a minority. What I have been saying, I think, suggests that in Switzerland, which is not an untypical country, this is not the way it happens. What happens is that decisions are taken in rather sensible, responsible ways, and they are the decisions of the whole people. They are a proper form of democracy. Thank you.